It is their multifariousness. Some perfectly good flowers simply are what they are, singular and, if not completely fixed in their identity, capable of ringing only a few simple changes on it. Hue, say, or petal count. Prod it all you want, select and cross and re-engineer it, but there's only so much a coneflower or a lotus is ever going to do. Fashion is apt to pick up such a flower for a time and then drop it. Think of the pink or gillyflower in Shakespeare's day, or the hyacinth in Queen Victoria's. Since it won't let itself be remade in some new image once its first one is passé. By contrast, the rose, the orchid, and the tulip are capable of prodigies, reinventing themselves again and again to suit every change in the aesthetic or political weather. The rose, flung open and ravishing in Elizabethan times, obligingly buttoned herself up and turned prim for the Victorians. When the Dutch decided the paragon of floral beauty was a marbleized swirl of vividly contrasting colors, the petals of their tulips became extravagantly feathered and flamed. But then, when the English went in big for carpet bedding in the 19th century, the tulips duly allowed themselves to be turned into a paint box filled with the brightest, fattest dabs of pure pigment, suitable for massing. These are the sorts of flowers that bear our oddest notions gladly. Of course, their willingness to take part in the moving game of human culture has proven a brilliant strategy for their success. For there are a lot more roses and tulips around today, in a lot more places, than there were before people took an interest in them. For a flower, the path to world domination passes through humanity's ever-shifting ideals of beauty. It isn't automatically obvious that the tulip belongs in this august company of flowers, probably because, in its modern incarnation, the tulip is such a simple, one-dimensional flower, and its rich history of being so much more than that has largely been lost. Compared to the rose or the peony, flowers whose historical forms survive alongside their modern incarnations, both because the plants are so long-lived and because they can be cloned indefinitely, the only way we have any idea what made a tulip beautiful in Turkish or Dutch or French eyes is through those people's paintings and botanical illustrations. That's because a tulip that falls out of favor soon goes extinct, since the bulbs don't reliably come back every year. In general, a strain won't last unless it is regularly replanted, so the chain of genetic continuity can be broken in a generation. Even when people do continue to plant a particular tulip, the vigor of that variety, which is propagated by removing and planting the bulb's offsets, the little genetically identical bulblets that form at its base, eventually fades until it must be abandoned. Breeders today are busily seeking a new black tulip because they know the current standard bearer, Queen of Night, is probably on her way out. Tulips, in other words, are mortal. No tulip appears in the flower-crowded borders of medieval tapestries, nor is the flower ever mentioned in the early herbals, the old-world encyclopedias of the world's known plants and their uses. The fierceness of the passion that the tulip unleashed in Holland in the 17th century, and to a lesser extent in France and England, may have had something to do with the flower's novelty in the West and the suddenness of its appearance. It is the youngest of our canonical flowers, the rose being the oldest. Ogier Ghislain de Busbecq, ambassador of the Austrian Habsburgs to the court of Suleiman the Magnificent in Constantinople, claimed to have introduced the tulip to Europe, sending a consignment of bulbs west from Constantinople soon after he arrived there in 1554. The word tulip is a corruption of the Turkish word for turban. The fact that the tulip's first official trip west took it from one court to another, that it was a flower favored by royalty, may also have contributed to its quick ascendancy, for court fashions have always been especially catching. The tulips is not a case where a plant had to travel the world before its virtues could be recognized at home. By the time of Busbecq's consignment, the tulip already had its own cult of admirers in the East, who had taken the flower a considerable distance from its form in the wild. There it typically appears as a short, pretty, cheerful flower, a frank, open-faced, six-petaled star, often with a dramatic splotch of contrasting color at the base. Species tulips in Turkey typically come in red, less commonly in white or yellow. The Ottoman Turks had discovered that these wild tulips were great changelings, freely hybridizing, though it takes 7 years before a tulip grown from seed flowers and shows its new colors, but also subject to mutations that produced spontaneous and wondrous changes in form and color. The tulip's mutability was taken as a sign that nature cherished this flower above all others. In his 1597 herbal, John Gerard says of the tulip that nature seems to play more with this flower than with any other that I do know. The tulip's genetic variability has in fact given nature, or more precisely natural selection, a great deal to play with. From among the chance mutations thrown out by a flower, nature preserves the rare ones that confer some advantage. Brighter color, more perfect symmetry, whatever. For millions of years, such features were selected, in effect, by the tulip's pollinators, that is, insects, until the Turks came along and began to cast their own votes. The Turks did not learn to make deliberate crosses till the 1600s. The novel tulips they prized were said simply to have occurred. Darwin called such a process artificial, as opposed to natural selection. But from the flower's point of view, this is a distinction without a difference. Individual plants in which a trait desired by either bees or Turks occurred wound up with more offspring. Though we self-importantly regard domestication as something people have done to plants, it is at the same time a strategy by which the plants have exploited us and our desires, even our most idiosyncratic notions of beauty, to advance their own interests. Depending on the environment in which a species finds itself, different adaptations will avail. Mutations that nature would have rejected out of hand in the wild sometimes prove to be brilliant adaptations in an environment that's been shaped by human desire. In the environment of the Ottoman Empire, the best way for a tulip to get ahead was to have absurdly long petals drawn to a point fine as a needle. In drawings, paintings, and ceramics, the only place the Turk's ideal of tulip beauty survives, the human environment is an unstable one, these elongated blooms look as though they'd been stretched to the limit by a glassblower. The metaphor of choice for this form of tulip petal was the dagger. A successful Ottoman tulip also had to be pure in color and have smooth-edged petals held closely enough together to hide the anthers within, and it could never be doubled. Have a superabundance of petals in the way of a hybrid rose. Though these last traits are not uncommon in species tulips, attenuated petals are virtually unknown in the wild, which suggests that the Ottoman ideal of tulip beauty, elegant, sharp, and masculine, was freakish and hard-won and conferred no advantage in nature. Very often, traits that commend plants and animals to people render them less fit for life in the wild. Beyond a certain point, the Ottoman and insect ideals of tulip beauty no longer coincided. For a time in the 18th century, the bulbs of tulips that matched the Turkish ideal traded in Constantinople for quantities of gold. This was during the reign of Sultan Ahmed III, from 1703 to 1730, a period known to Turkish historians as the Lal Duvri, or Tulip Era. The Sultan was ruled by his passion for the flower, so much so that he imported bulbs by the millions from Holland, where the Dutch, after the passing of their own tulipomania, had become masters of large-scale bulb production. The extravagance of the Sultan's annual tulip festivals ultimately proved his downfall. The conspicuous waste of national treasure helped fire the revolt that ended his rule. Each spring, for a period of weeks, the imperial gardens were filled with prize tulips, Turkish, Dutch, Iranian, all of them shown to their best advantage. Tulips whose petals had flexed too wide were held shut with fine threads hand-tied. Most of the bulbs had been grown in place, but these were supplemented by thousands of cut stems held in glass bottles. The scale of the display was further compounded by mirrors placed strategically around the garden. Each variety was marked with a label made from silver filigree. In place of every fourth flower, a candle, its wick trimmed to tulip height, was set into the ground. Songbirds in gilded cages supplied the music, and hundreds of giant tortoises carrying candles on their backs lumbered through the gardens, further illuminating the display. All the guests were required to dress in colors that flattered those of the tulips. At the appointed moment, a cannon sounded, the doors to the harem were flung open, and the sultan's mistresses stepped into the garden, led by eunuchs bearing torches. The whole scene was repeated every night for as long as the tulips were in blossom, for as long as Sultan Ahmed managed to cling to his throne. A theft lies behind the rise of the tulip in Holland. One of the recipients of the first tulips to arrive in Europe was Carolus Clusius, a cosmopolitan plantsman who played a seminal role in the distribution of newly discovered plants through Europe. Bulbs were his specialty, and Clusius is credited with the introduction or spread of fritillarias, irises, hyacinths, anemones, ranunculi, narcissi, and lilies. The tulips came into Clusius's hands because he was director of the Imperial Botanical Garden in Vienna. When he moved to Leiden to establish a new physic garden in 1593, he took some of the bulbs with him. According to Anna Pavord's History of the Tulip, the flower was already growing, with little fanfare, in at least one Leiden garden by the time of Clusius's arrival. But Clusius was so ostentatiously possessive of his rare tulips that he made the Dutch covet them, with disastrous consequences for his collection. In the words of one contemporary account, no one could procure them, not even for money. So plans were made by which the best and most of his plants were stolen by night, whereupon he lost courage and the desire to continue their cultivation. But those who had stolen the tulips lost no time in increasing them by sowing the seeds, and by this means the 17 provinces were well stocked. Two things about this story are noteworthy. The first is that the stolen tulips were propagated by seed. Tulips, like apples, do not come true from seed. Their offspring bear little resemblance to their parents. What this means is that, given the flower's inherent variability, the 17 provinces of Holland would have been stocked with an extraordinary array of differently shaped and colored tulips. This promiscuous seeding of tulips may well have been the source of much of the astounding variety the Dutch managed to coax from the flower, a botanical treasure that became a point of national pride in the 17th century. Holland's tulips were mentioned in the same breath as its invincible navy and unparalleled republican liberties. The second noteworthy point about the story is that it puts a theft at the source of Holland's long, illustrious, and ignominious relationship with the tulip. This was not the first or last time a theft attended the appearance of a new plant. The potato might never have prospered in France if not for a similar theft from the royal gardens of Louis XVI. Very often in myth, a theft and its consequence of shame lies at the root of a human achievement. Think of Prometheus's theft of fire from the sun or Eve's tasting of the fruit of knowledge. Shame seems to be the going price of achievement, particularly the achievement of knowledge or beauty. For the Dutch, at least, shame has shadowed the tulip's story from the start, though fainter manifestations of the same shadow are probably never far from the culture of flowers. It's there in the wastefulness and extravagance we often associate with flowers, in the sensual pleasure we take in them, in our satisfaction at forcing them beyond their natural forms and colors and blooming times. Even in the tiny pang that can accompany the petty theft of a flower that's been cut and brought indoors. The modern tulip has become such a cheap and ubiquitous commodity that it's hard for us to recover a sense of the glamour that once surrounded the flower. That glamour surely had something to do with its roots in the Orient. Anna Pavord speaks of the intoxicating aura of the infidels that surrounded the tulip. There was, too, the preciousness of the early tulips, the supply of which could be increased only very slowly through offsets, a quirk of biology that kept supply well behind demand. In France, in 1608, a miller exchanged his mill for a bulb of Mère Brune. Around the same time, a bridegroom accepted a single tulip as the whole of his dowry. Happily, we are told, the variety became known as Mariage de ma fille. Yet tulipomania in France and England never reached the pitch it would in Holland. How can the mad embrace of these particular people and this particular flower be explained? For good reason, the Dutch have never been content to accept nature as they found it. Lacking in conventional charms and variety, the landscape of the Low Countries is spectacularly flat, monotonous, and swampy. An universal quagmire is how one Englishman described the place, the buttock of the world. What beauty there is in the Netherlands is largely the result of human effort. The dikes and canals built to drain the land, the windmills erected to interrupt the unbroken sweep of wind across it. In his famous essay on tulipomania, The Bitter Smell of Tulips, the poet Zbigniew Herbert suggests that the monotony of the Dutch landscape gave rise to dreams of multifarious, colorful, and unusual flora. Such dreams could be indulged as never before in 17th century Holland, as Dutch traders and plant explorers returned home with a parade of exotic new plant species. Botany became a national pastime, followed as closely and avidly as we follow sports today. This was a nation and a time in which a botanical treatise could become a bestseller and a plantsman like Clusius a celebrity. Land in Holland being so scarce and expensive, Dutch gardens were miniatures, measured in square feet rather than acres, and frequently augmented with mirrors. The Dutch thought of their gardens as jewel boxes, and in such a space, even a single flower, and especially one as erect, singular, and strikingly colored as a tulip, could make a powerful statement. To make such statements, about one's sophistication, about one's wealth, has always been one of the reasons people plant gardens. In the 17th century, the Dutch were the richest people in Europe, and, as the historian Simon Schemer shows in The Embarrassment of Riches, their Calvinist faith did not keep them from indulging in the pleasures of conspicuous display. The exoticism and expense of tulips certainly recommended them for this purpose, but so did the fact that, among flowers, the tulip is one of the most extravagantly useless. Up until the Renaissance, most of the flowers in cultivation had been useful as well as beautiful. They were sources of medicine, perfume, or even food. In the West, flowers have often come under attack from various Puritans, and what has always saved them has been their practical uses. It was utility, not beauty, that earned the rose and lily, the peony, and all the rest a spot in the gardens of monks and Shakers and colonial Americans who would otherwise have had nothing to do with them. When the tulip first arrived in Europe, people set about fashioning some utilitarian purpose for it. The Germans boiled and sugared the bulbs and, unconvincingly, declared them a delicacy. The English tried serving them up with oil and vinegar. Pharmacists proposed the tulip as a remedy for flatulence. None of these uses caught on, however. The tulip remained itself, Herbert writes, the poetry of nature to which vulgar utilitarianism is foreign. The tulip was a thing of beauty, no more, no less. If the tulip's useless beauty suited the Dutch taste for display, it also meshed with the age's humanism, which was striving to put some breathing space between art and religion. Unlike the rose or the lily, say, the tulip had not yet been enlisted as a Christian symbol, though tulipomania would eventually change that. To paint a vase of tulips was to delve into the wonders of nature rather than into the storehouse of iconography. I also think the particular character of the tulip's beauty made it a good match for the Dutch temperament. Generally bereft of scent, the tulip is the coolest of floral characters. In fact, the Dutch counted the tulip's lack of scent as a virtue, a proof of the flower's chasteness and moderation. Petals curving inward to hide its sexual organs, the tulip is an introvert among flowers. It is also somewhat aloof. One bloom per stem, one stem per plant. The tulip allows us to admire it, Herbert observes, but does not awaken violent emotions, desire, jealousy, or erotic fevers. None of these qualities would seem to portend the frenzy to come. But as it would happen, the outward composure of Dutchman and tulip alike held sleeping within it something else. One crucial element of the beauty of the tulip that intoxicated the Dutch, the Turks, the French, and the English has been lost to us. To them, the tulip was a magic flower because it was prone to spontaneous and brilliant eruptions of color. In a planting of 100 tulips, one of them might be so possessed, opening to reveal the white or yellow ground of its petals, painted, as if by the finest brush and steadiest hand, with intricate feathers or flames of a vividly contrasting hue. When this happened, the tulip was said to have broken, and if a tulip broke in a particularly striking manner, if the flames of the applied color reached clear to the petal's lip, say, and its pigment was brilliant and pure and its pattern symmetrical, the owner of that bulb had won the lottery. For the offsets of that bulb would inherit its pattern and hues and command a fantastic price. The fact that broken tulips for some unknown reason produced fewer and smaller offsets than ordinary tulips drove their prices still higher. Semper Augustus was the most famous such break. The closest we have to a broken tulip today is the group known as the Rembrandts, so named because Rembrandt painted some of the most admired breaks of his time. But these latter-day tulips, with their heavy patterning of one or more contrasting colors, look clumsy by comparison, as if painted in haste with a thick brush. To judge from the paintings we have of the originals, the petals of broken tulips could be as fine and intricate as marbleized papers, the extravagant swirls of color somehow managing to seem both bold and delicate at once. In the most striking examples, such as the fiery carmine that Semper Augustus splashed on its pure white ground, the outbreak of color juxtaposed with the orderly, linear form of the tulip could be breathtaking, with the leaping, wayward patterns just barely contained by the petal's edge. Anna Pavord recounts the extraordinary lengths to which Dutch growers would go to make their tulips break, sometimes borrowing their techniques from alchemists, who faced what must have seemed a comparable challenge. Over the earth, above a bed planted with white tulips, gardeners would liberally sprinkle paint powders of the desired hue, on the theory that rainwater would wash the color down to the roots, where it would be taken up by the bulb. Charlatans sold recipes believed to produce the magic color breaks. Pigeon droppings were thought to be an effective agent, as was plaster dust taken from the walls of old houses. Unlike the alchemists, whose attempts to change base metals into gold reliably failed, now and then the would-be tulip changers would be rewarded with a good break, inspiring everybody to redouble their efforts. What the Dutch could not have known was that a virus was responsible for the magic of the broken tulip, a fact that, as soon as it was discovered, doomed the beauty it had made possible. The color of a tulip actually consists of two pigments working in concert, a base color that is always yellow or white, and a second laid-on color called an anthocyanin. The mix of these two hues determines the unitary color we see. The virus works by partially and irregularly suppressing the anthocyanin, thereby allowing a portion of the underlying color to show through. It wasn't until the 1920s, after the invention of the electron microscope, that scientists discovered the virus was being spread from tulip to tulip by Mysis persici, the peach potato aphid. Peach trees were a common feature of 17th century gardens. By the 1920s, the Dutch regarded their tulips as commodities to trade rather than jewels to display. And since the virus weakened the bulbs it infected, the reason the offsets of broken tulips were so small and few in number, Dutch growers set about ridding their fields of the infection. Color breaks, when they did occur, were promptly destroyed, and a certain peculiar manifestation of natural beauty abruptly lost its claim on human affection. I can't help thinking that the virus was supplying something the tulip needed, just the touch of abandon the flower's chilly formality called for. Maybe that's why the broken tulip became such a treasure in 17th century Holland. The wayward color loosed on a tulip by a good break perfected the flower, even as the virus responsible set about destroying it. On its face, the story of the virus and the tulip would seem to throw a wrench into any evolutionary understanding of beauty. What possible good could it do a flower for an infection that decreases its fitness to enhance its appeal to people? I suppose a case could be made that the virus, by adding fuel to the frenzy of tulipomania, led to the planting of many more tulips in the hope of finding more breaks. But the fact remains that, because of people's idiosyncratic notion of tulip beauty, for several hundred years, tulips were selected for a trait that would sicken and eventually kill them. This would seem to represent a perversion of natural selection, a violation of the laws of nature. And so it is, considered from the vantage point of the tulip. But what if the question is considered instead from the vantage point of the virus? The rule of law is restored. What the virus did was to insinuate itself into the relationship between people and flowers, in effect exploiting human ideas of tulip beauty in order to advance its own selfish purposes. Which, if you think about it, is not so different from what humans did when they elbowed into the old relationship of bees and flowers. The more beautiful the breaks produced by the infection, the greater the number of infected plants in Dutch gardens, and the more total virus in circulation. What a trick! As a survival strategy, the virus's scheme was brilliant, at least as long as people didn't figure out what was going on. For where else in nature has a disease rendered a living thing more lovely? And not just lovely, but lovely in a previously unimagined way. For the virus created an entirely new way for a tulip to be beautiful, at least in our eyes. The virus altered the eye of the beholder. That this change came at the expense of the beheld suggests that beauty in nature does not necessarily bespeak health, nor necessarily redound to the benefit of the beautiful. The transformation of the tulip from a jewel box flower to a virus-free commodity has made the tulip oddly hard to see. Massed in the landscape, tulips register on us mostly as instances of pure color. They could almost be lollipops or lipsticks in the landscape. At least this is how they used to register on me, as eye candy, pleasurable enough but weightless. I am not by nature a great noticer, and for all the years between the time when my parents paid me to plant tulips in our yard and the spring of this writing, the beauty of tulips, their specific beauty, was lost on me. But I don't think the problem is unique to me. Beauty always takes place in the particular, the critic Elaine Scarry has written, and if there are no particulars, the chances of seeing it go down. In a sense, particular tulips are hard to come by. Because they are so cheap and ubiquitous, that's partly why, but also because their form and color are, more than those of most flowers, peculiarly abstract. Far more than a rose, say, or a peony, an actual specific tulip closely resembles our preconceived idea of a tulip. By now, the tulip's parabolic curves are as deeply etched into consciousness as a Coke bottle's. With a fidelity that is remarkable, and that is far more typical of a commodity than a thing in nature, the tulips one meets in the world match the tulips resident in one's head. In color, too, tulips are so uniform and faithful, like paint chips, to whatever shade they profess to be that we quickly take it in, this idea of yellow or red or white, and then move on to consume the next visual treat. Tulips are so tulip-like, so platonically themselves, that they skate past our regard like models on a runway. One way to begin to slow down and recover the particular beauty of a tulip I discovered this spring is to bring one indoors and look at it individually. This, I think, may be even more helpful than planting older or more exotic varieties, for I suspect that even some of the Triumphs and Darwins sold in the mass market mesh bags would, if cut and brought indoors and then really looked at, also hold the power to astonish. It is no accident that botanical illustrators and photographers have so often brought their scrupulous eye to bear on this particular flower. It rewards that particular gaze like no other. I eventually want to bring that gaze briefly to bear on a single tulip, the Queen of Night sitting before me on my desk this late May morning. Queen of Night is as close to black as a flower gets, though in fact it is a dark and glossy maroonish purple. Its hue is so dark, however, that it appears to draw more light into itself than it reflects, a kind of floral black hole. In the garden, depending on the angle of the sun, the blossoms of a Queen of Night may read as positive or negative space, as flowers or shadows of a flower. This particular effect was prized by the Dutch, and the quest for a truly black tulip, a quest that has gone on for at least 400 years and goes on still, became one of the more intriguing subplots of tulipomania. Alexandre Dumas-Pere wrote a whole novel, The Black Tulip, about a competition in 17th century Holland to grow the first truly black tulip. The greed and intrigue inspired by the contest. In the novel, the Horticultural Society had put up a prize of 100,000 guilders, destroyed three lives. By the time the miraculous tulip appears, Cornelius, the man who bred it, is in jail, wrongly imprisoned on a tip by his neighbor who has claimed the prize flower as his own. Cornelius glimpses the culmination of his life's work through the bars of his cell. The tulip was beautiful, splendid, magnificent. Its stem was more than 18 inches high. It rose from out of four green leaves, which were as smooth and straight as iron lance heads. The whole of the flower was as black and shining as jet. But why a black tulip? Perhaps because the color black is so rare in nature, or at least in living nature, and tulipomania was nothing if not a vast and precarious edifice poised on the finest points of botanical rarity. Black also carries connotations of evil, and the mania would later come to be seen as a morality tale about worldly temptation, in which a whole people succumbed, ruinously, to not one but an entire bouquet of deadly sins. At the same time, black, like white, is a blankness onto which any and all desire or fear may be projected. For Dumas, the black tulip was a synecdoche for tulipomania itself, an indifferent and arbitrary mirror in which a perverse consensus of meaning and value came briefly and disastrously into focus. A second story is told, this one possibly true, about a black tulip discovered by a poor shoemaker at the height of the madness. In the version that Zbigniew Herbert tells, five gentlemen from the Union of Florists in Harlem, all dressed in black, pay a visit to the shoemaker, professing to do him a good turn by offering to buy his tulip bulb. The shoemaker, sensing their avarice, begins to bargain in earnest, and after much haggling, the two parties settle on a price for the bulb, 1,500 florins, a sum that to the shoemaker is a windfall. The bulb changes hands. Now something unexpected happened, Herbert writes, something that in drama is called a turning point. The florists throw the precious bulb to the ground and stomp it to a pulp. "You idiot," they shouted at the stupefied shoepatcher. "We also have a bulb of the black tulip. Besides us, no one else in the world. No king, no emperor or sultan. If you had asked 10,000 florins for your bulb and a couple of horses on top of it, we would have paid without a word. And remember this, Good fortune won't smile on you a second time in your entire life because you are a blockhead. The shoemaker, devastated, staggers to his bed in the attic and dies. Herbert's view of the tulipomania is itself unremittingly black. To him, the Dutch frenzy had nothing whatever to do with beauty, only with the consuming evil of the fixed idea, a phenomenon that can, at any time, destroy the sanctuaries of reason on which civilization depends. Herbert's tulipomania is a parable of utopianism, specifically of communism. It is true that, after a certain point, the flowers themselves became irrelevant. A time came when crushing a particular tulip bulb or holding a paper futures contract for another still in the ground conferred greater wealth than the most beautiful blossom ever beheld. Still, it's important to remember that what ended in Holland in madness had begun with the desire for beauty in a place where, it seemed to many, beauty was in comparatively short supply. This was also a country, remember, where everyone, regardless of social class, dressed remarkably alike, in the sartorial equivalent of a monotone. Color in this gray Calvinist land must have struck the eye with unimaginable force, and the color of tulips was like no color anyone had ever laid eyes on before. Saturated, brilliant, more intense than that of any other flower. The story of the Semper Augustus, the most celebrated and expensive tulip for most of the 17th century, is a reminder that beauty did in fact underwrite the mania, that, at least in Holland in the 1630s, pork bellies could never have substituted for tulips. The consensus was that Semper Augustus was the most beautiful flower in the world, a masterpiece. The color is white, with carmine on a blue base, and with an unbroken flame right to the top, Nicholas van Wassenaer wrote in 1624 after seeing the tulip in the garden of one Dr. Adrian Poe. Never did a florist see one more beautiful than this. There were only a dozen or so specimens in existence, and Dr. Poe owned nearly all of them. This passionate tulip fancier, who was a director of the new East India Company, grew them on his estate in Hempstead, near Haarlem, where he had deployed an elaborate mirrored gazebo in his garden to multiply the effect of his precious blooms. Through the 1620s, Dr. Poe was bombarded with wildly escalating offers to sell his Semper Augustus bulbs, but he would not part with them at any price. That refusal, which at least one historian credits with igniting the mania, was grounded in the fact that, as Wassenaer tells us, this connoisseur judged the pleasure of looking at a Semper Augustus far superior to any profit. Before the speculation came the looking. Looking at my own black tulip, the Queen of Night, here on my desk, I can see it has the classic form of the single tulip. Six petals arrayed in two tiers, three inner petals cupped inside three outer ones, that draw an oblong vault of space around the flower's sexual parts, simultaneously advertising and sheltering them from view. Each petal is at once a flag and a curtain, drawn. I see, too, that the petals are not identical. The inner petals have a small, delicate cleft at the top, while the sturdier outer ones form uninterrupted ovals, their incised edges as clean as a blade's. The petals look soft and silky, but are not. To the touch, they're unexpectedly hard, like orchid petals, and no more silky than this page. Together, the six convex petals fit together to form a tailored, somewhat austere blossom. Inviting neither touch nor smell, the flower asks me to admire it from a distance. The fact that Queen of Night has no detectable scent is fitting. This is an experience designed strictly for the delectation of the eye. The long, curving stem of my Queen of Night is nearly as beautiful as the flower it supports. It is graceful, but graceful in a specifically masculine way. This is not the grace of a woman's neck as much as that of a stone sculpture or the curving steel cables of a suspension bridge. The curve seems economical, purposeful, inevitable in its structural logic, even as it changes over time. A horticulturally inclined mathematician would no doubt be able to represent the stem of my tulip in a differential equation. As the day warms, the curve of the stem relaxes and the petals pull back to reveal the flower's interior space and organs. Like everything else about the tulip, these too are explicit and logical. 6 stamens, one for every petal, circle around a sturdy, upright pedestal, each of them extending, like trembling suitors, a powdery yellow bouquet. Crowning the central pedestal, which botanists call a style, is the stigma, a pursed set of slightly crooked lips, typically 3, poised to receive the grains of pollen, conducting them downward toward the flower's ovary. Sometimes, as now, a single glistening droplet of liquid, nectar, dew, appears on the stigma's lip, a suggestion of receptiveness. Everything about tulip sex seems orderly and intelligible. There is none of the occult mystery that attends the sexuality of, say, a bourbon rose or a doubled peony. Those two are flowers in which one imagines a bumblebee being forced to feel his way around in the dark, stumbling blindly, drunkenly, getting himself all tangled in their innumerable petals. Which is precisely the idea, of course. But it is not the tulip's idea. In this, I think, lies the key to the distinctive personality of the tulip, if not to the nature of floral beauty in general. Compared to the other canonical flowers, the beauty of the tulip is classical rather than romantic. Or, to borrow the useful dichotomy drawn by the Greeks, the tulip is that rare figure of Apollonian beauty in a horticultural pantheon mainly presided over by Dionysus. Certainly the rose and peony are Dionysian flowers, deeply sensual and captivating us as much through the senses of touch and smell as sight. The entirely unreasonable multiplication of their petals, one Chinese tree peony is said to have more than 300, defies clear seeing and good sense. The profusion of folds edges toward a gorgeous, intoxicating incoherence. To lean in and inhale the breath of a rose or peony is momentarily to leave our rational selves behind, to be transported as only a haunting fragrance can transport us. This is what is meant by ecstasy, to be taken out of ourselves. Such flowers propose a dream of abandon instead of form. The tulip, by contrast, is all Apollonian clarity and order. It's a linear, left-brained sort of flower, in no way occult, explicit and logical in its formal rules and arrangements. 6 petals corresponding to 6 stamens, and conveying all this rationality the only way conceivable, through the eye. The clean, steely stem holds the solitary flower up in the air for our admiration, positing its lucid form over and above the uncertain, shifting earth. The tulip's blooms float above nature's turmoil. Even when they expire, they do so gracefully. Instead of turning to mush like a spent rose, or to used Kleenex like peony petals, the 6 petals on a tulip cleanly, dryly, and often simultaneously shatter. Friedrich Nietzsche described Apollo, in contrast to Dionysus, as the god of individuation and just boundaries. Unlike the great mass of flowers, a tulip bloom stands as an individual in the landscape or vase. One bloom per plant, each one perched atop its stem very much like a head. Recall that the word tulip comes from the Turkish word for turban. Lower down the figure come the elongated leaves, precisely 2 in most botanical renderings, often deployed like limbs. It's no surprise that the tulip was the first flower to have its cultivars individually named, and named for individuals. But unlike most other flowers, which bear female or feminine names, the nomenclature of tulips, Queen of Night notwithstanding, is rife with the names of great men, especially generals and admirals. In the Greek mind, the Dionysian was most often associated with the female principle, or at least with androgyny, the Apollonian with the male. Similarly, the Chinese divided flowers, like everything else, into female yin and male yang. In Chinese thought, the soft and extravagantly petaled peony blossom represents the very essence of yin, though its more linear stems and roots are deemed to be yang. Biologically speaking, most flowers, including tulips, are bisexual, containing both male and female organs. Yet in our imaginations, they tend to lean one way or the other, their forms recalling masculine or feminine beauty, and sometimes even male or female organs. There's a rose in my garden, blousily doubled and colored the palest pink, that the French call cuisse de nymphe émue. It was not enough, apparently, to liken this seductive bloom to the thigh of a nymph, so it became thigh of an aroused nymph. You can walk through any garden and choose upsides. Boy, girl, girl, girl. The canonical flowers seem to me almost all female, except, that is, for the tulip, perhaps the most masculine of flowers. If you doubt this, watch next April how a tulip forces its head up out of the ground, how the head gradually colors as it rises. Dig down along the shaft and you'll find its bulb, smooth, rounded, hard as a nut, a form for which the botanists offer a most graphic term, testiculate. Of course, like all of our Apollonian efforts to order and categorize nature, this one goes only so far before the Dionysian pull of things as they really are begins to take its inevitable toll. I mentioned the orderly arrangement of petals and stamens on the Queen of Night on my desk, yet when I went back to the garden to cut another, I have a completely unreasonable number of Queen of Nights in my garden, I noticed for the first time that the bed was teeming with subtle perversities. Here were Queen of Nights with 9 and even 10 petals, mutant stigmas with 6 lips instead of 3, and in one case, a leaf streaked with deep purple, as if its dull green had been infiltrated by the colored petals overhead, their pigments somehow seeping through the plant's body like a dye or drug. As anyone who grows a lot of them knows, tulips are prone to such eruptions of biological irrationality. Chance mutations, color breaks, and instances of thievery. Thievery is the tulip grower's term for a mysterious phenomenon that causes certain flowers in a field to revert to the form and color of their parent. What I saw in my bed of nights was an instance of the wondrous instability that inspired the belief that nature liked to play with tulips more than with any other flower. A few weeks ago, I passed through Grand Army Plaza in Manhattan, where a large flower bed off Fifth Avenue had been planted with thousands of fat yellow triumphs, arranged with dulling parade ground precision. They were exactly the sort of stiff, primary-colored tulips I used to plant in my parents' yard. I'd read that even today, at a time when tulip growers struggle mightily to keep their fields free of the virus that causes the flower to break, it still occasionally happens. And there, in the middle of that relentless, monotonous bed, I spotted one. A violent eruption of red on a chaste canary petal. It wasn't the most handsome of breaks, but the flare of carmine leaping up from the base of that one bloom stood out in the grid of conformists like an exuberant clown, pulling the rug out from under the dream of order this flowerbed was meant to represent. And there was something thrilling about it. I could hardly believe my luck. To me, that careless splash of red seemed almost like a visitation of the distant tulip past, yes, for here was the return of the virus so assiduously repressed, but of something else, too, some inchoate underground force that riveted me. It was as if the whole grid of flowers and, by extension, the grid of the city itself had been put in doubt by that one ecstatic, wayward pulse of life. Or was it death? I guess you'd have to say it was both. Then, that night, I dreamt about what I'd witnessed, the stiff yellow grid and its solitary red joker. In the dream version, the broken tulip appears in the front row, and right beside it lies a fancy fountain pen, a Mont Blanc. This is all too embarrassing to make up. In a gesture of impetuousness completely out of character, I grab them both, the broken tulip and the pen, and run like a man possessed up Fifth Avenue. I'm flying by the spinning doors of the Plaza and Pierre hotels when I snag the attention of the two brass-buttoned doormen standing sentry outside the Pierre. They can have no idea who I am or what I've done, but they leap to and give slapstick chase anyway, their cartoon hollerings, "Stop! Thief!" sounding in my ears as I tear up the avenue, clutching my tulip and pen and laughing hysterically at the absurdity of it all. The circumstance, but also the dream about it. Color breaks, far more beautiful than the one I saw on Fifth Avenue, had helped fire the tulipomania, a speculative frenzy that, like the breaks themselves, can perhaps best be understood as an explosive outbreak of the Dionysian in the too strict Apollonian world of the tulip, and of the Dutch bourgeoisie. This, at least, is how I've come to think of the tulipomania. As a festival of Dionysus, by turns ecstatic and destructive, transplanted from the forest or temple to the orderly precincts of the marketplace. Tulipomania bore all the hallmarks of a medieval carnival, in which, for a brief orgasmic interim, in the words of the French historian Leroy Ladurie, the stable order of society was turned on its head. A carnival is a social ritual of sanctioned craziness and release, a way for a community to temporarily indulge its Dionysian urges. For its duration, the identity of everyone swept into its vortex is up for grabs. The village idiot is made king, the poor man suddenly rich, the rich man just as suddenly a pauper. Everyday roles and values are suddenly, thrillingly suspended, and astounding new possibilities arise. As with society, so with capitalism in the throes of a speculative mania. All of its values are turned on their head. Thrift, patience, value for money, reward for effort. For as long as the carnival of capitalism lasts, the rules of logic are repealed, or rather recast along new lines, ones that will appear absurd in the cold light of the morning after, but that make impeccable sense within the fevered space of the speculative bubble. It's hard to date with precision exactly when the bubble in Holland formed, but the autumn of 1635 marked a turning point. That's when the trade in actual bulbs gave way to the trade in promissory notes, slips of paper listing details of the flowers in question, the dates they would be delivered, and their price. Before then, the tulip market followed the rhythm of the season. Bulbs could change hands only between the months of June, when they were lifted from the ground, and October, when they had to be planted again. Frenzied as it was, the market before 1635 was still rooted in reality. Cash money for actual flowers. Now began the windhandel, the wind trade. Suddenly, the tulip trade was a year-round affair, and the connoisseurs and growers who shared a genuine interest in the flowers were joined by legions of newly minted florists who couldn't have cared less. These men were speculators who, only days before, had been carpenters and weavers, woodcutters and glassblowers, smiths, cobblers, coffee grinders, farmers, tradesmen, peddlers, clergymen, schoolmasters, lawyers, and apothecaries. One burglar in Amsterdam pawned the tools of his trade so that he too could become a speculator in tulips. Rushing to get in on the sure thing, these people sold their businesses, mortgaged their homes, and invested their life savings in slips of paper representing future flowers. Predictably, the flood of fresh capital into the market drove prices to bracing new heights. In the space of a month, the price of a red and yellow striped Giel Anderoot van Leyden leapt from 46 guilders to 515. A bulb of Switzers, a yellow tulip feathered with red, soared from 60 to 1800 guilders. At its height, the trade in tulips was conducted by florists in colleges, back rooms of taverns given over to the new business 2 or 3 days a week. Colleges quickly developed a set of rituals that sound like a cross between orderly stock market protocol and a drinking contest. Under one common set of procedures, called met de borden, or with the boards, a seller and buyer who wanted to do business were handed slates on which they wrote an opening price for the tulip in question. The slates were then passed to a pair of proxies, essentially arbitrators nominated by the traders, who would then settle on a price somewhere between the two opening bids. This they would scribble on the slates before passing them back to the principals. The traders could either let the number stand, signifying agreement, or rub it out. If both rubbed out the price, the deal was off. But if only one party declined, that florist had to pay a fine to the college, an incentive to close the deal. When a deal did close, the buyer had to pay a small commission called the Vinkupsgeld, wine money. In keeping with the carnival atmosphere, these fines and commissions were used to buy wine and beer for everyone, another incentive to make deals. In a satirical pamphlet describing the scene, an old-timer advises his neophyte friend to drink up. This trade must be done with an intoxicated head, and the bolder one is, the better. The bubble logic driving tulipomania has since acquired a name, the greater fool theory. Although by any conventional measure it is folly to pay thousands for a tulip bulb, or for that matter, an internet stock, as long as there is an even greater fool out there willing to pay even more, doing so is the most logical thing in the world. By 1636, the taverns were crowded with such people, and as long as Holland remained home to an expanding population of greater fools, people blinded by their desire for instant wealth, the truly foolish act would have been to abstain from the tulip trade. It might also be that for some of the Calvinist Dutch, financial abandon offered a way to atone for what they felt was the shame of their wealth, the embarrassment of their riches. They were trading their filthy lucre for the pristine beauty of a flower. Even so, there was more to the Vinhandel than mere wind. For the tulip craze marked the birth of a real business, the Dutch bulb trade that would long outlast the mania. The same could be said of our own internet bubble. Beneath the froth of speculation is a new and important industry. According to Joseph Schumpeter, it is not at all unusual for the birth of a new business to be attended by a speculative bubble as capital rushes in, dazzled by the young industry's wildly exaggerated promise. Every bubble sooner or later must burst. The carnival that was permanent would spell the end of the social order. In Holland, the crash came in the winter of 1637, for reasons that remain elusive. But with real tulips about to come out of the ground, paper trades and futures contracts would soon have to be settled. Real money would soon have to be exchanged for real bulbs, and the market grew jittery. On February 2nd, 1637, the florists of Haarlem gathered as usual to auction bulbs in one of the tavern colleges. A florist sought to begin the bidding at 1,250 guilders for a quantity of tulips. Switzers, in one account. Finding no takers, he tried again at 1,100, then 1,000, and all at once, every man in the room. Men who days before had themselves paid comparable sums for comparable tulips understood that the weather had changed. Haarlem was the capital of the bulb trade, and the news that there were no buyers to be found there ricocheted across the country. Within days, tulip bulbs were unsellable at any price. In all of Holland, a greater fool was no longer to be found. In the aftermath, many Dutch blamed the flower for their folly, as if the tulips themselves had, like the sirens, lured otherwise sensible men to their ruin. Broadsides excoriating the tulipomania became bestsellers. The fall of the great garden whore, the villain goddess Flora. Flora's Fool's Cap, or Scenes from the Remarkable Year 1637, when one fool hatched another, the idle rich lost their wealth, and the wise lost their senses. Charge against the pagan and Turkish tulip bulbs. Flora was, of course, the Roman goddess of flowers, who was a prostitute famous for bankrupting her lovers. In the months after the fever broke, a professor of botany at the University of Leiden, a man named Fortius, who occupied Clusius's old chair, could be seen patrolling the streets of the city, beating any tulip he encountered with his cane. At the conclusion of a medieval carnival, It was the carnival king who was hung in effigy. Likewise, the ancient festivals of Dionysus would end in destruction and mutilation, and the sacrifice of the god himself. It bears remembering that tulipomania was finally a frenzy not of consumption or of pleasure, but of financial speculation, and that it took place not in a country ordinarily given to large passions, but rather in the most stolid bourgeois culture of the time. The Dionysian eruptions of the tulip are relative, in other words, making an impression in direct proportion to their anomalousness.